Without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker of the conference, Dr. Jean-Pierre Filiou. Dr. Filiou joins us today from Sciences Po in Paris, where he has been an associate professor since 2006. His current research focuses on Islam and international relations, modern forms of political violence, messianic and millenarist movements. Dr. Filiou recently published his seventh book, The Arab Revolution, 10 Lessons from the Democratic Uprising. He will be speaking to us today about the historic and regional contextualities of the Arab Revolution.
So thank you so much. Do you hear me loud and clear? Because I don't speak loud and clear. So please do crazy gesture when you don't hear me. Is it okay? It's fine? I don't have to shout? No, it's not fine? Okay. Because I cannot speak louder. It's against my nature, principles. Will it work or no? No? Difficultly? So you really have to concentrate. You know, I have a 20-year background as a diplomat, and this is a negotiating technique. If you speak quite loud, people forget what they want to tell you, and they are compelled to enter your own scheme of thoughts. Anyway, so I'm so happy to be here, very honored to be, in fact, the first speaker at this first conference of its kind, if I understand it correctly. I'm not a frequent visitor enough to Scotland. I really regret that, even though in 1977, where you were not even born, you were not even thinking about being born, I climbed the Ben Nevis. It was in July, and I saw nothing because it was all foggy. So anyway, Scotland. So my first time at St. Andrews, I may say. Even though I try to compensate the fact that I don't visit Scotland enough by being a frequent patron at a Scottish pub called the Old Alliance. You know, we are French, you're Scottish, you get the point. Next to Le Marais in downtown Paris. And so after this alcoholic prelude, I will of course go into praising the students, which especially for me, who is only recently in the wonderful world of academia after 20 years as diplomat, before with NGO. This is really a daily refreshing discovery. You know, the way that students nowadays are so not only gifted, talented, ambitious, but they are empowered. And what we are witnessing today is only another illustration, of course. It's very stimulating. So what we agreed with the empowered student who organized this conference is that since this topic is generating so many interrogations, debates, I will speak half an hour and then we'll have half an hour for Q&A. Because as you will see, my presentation tend to not to be exactly mainstream. So probably it should generate some, I hope, positive reaction, but even if they are negative, that's the rule of the game. So this is only the first year one of the Arab Revolution. I don't say spring because I'm not into seasons and it's not about global warming. Because, you know, the spring expression helped a lot of commentators in autumn to say after the Arab Spring, the Islamist fall. After the Arab Spring, the fundamentalist winter, blah, 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 blah. I'm sure you read about it. It's all baloney. You say baloney, it's all baloney anyway. So it's not about spring. It's about a very long process, one of the most formidable historical waves of our time that is only beginning in front of our eyes. So the French Revolution lasts 100 years until finally we could stabilize it into the Third Republic. I'm convinced it won't be that long for the Arab Revolution. It will be much quicker, certainly. But I use a singular because I put it in as a echo to the Arab Renaissance, the Nahda, And so I try and portray this formidable movement as the sequel of already a 2-century-long chain of very dense event in the continuity of Arab peoples striving for liberation and emancipation. It's nothing new. It's just going on with a renewed force. Because the Arab Revolution is an Arab Renaissance. It is literally striving to revive a social body that has been paralyzed by the various autocrats, their predatory clique, and their unbridled security. On Tuesday, I was with the Syrian revolutionary, because we try and do more and more this academic revolutionary dialogue too, because obviously we benefit more than them, but it could be of some interest for them too. And he was telling me, I heard so many horrendous stories, and you, of course, you know, just look at the front page of The Guardian just yesterday about what is going on in Syria. And having lived in Syria for 3 years at the end of the 90s, I'm still appalled by the creativity of those people in torturing. But the story he told me on Tuesday was even beyond, because he had been buried alive for 7 years in a nailed coffin. To force him to go on TV and say the revolutionaries are jihadi gangs who are doing this and that, and of course he refused. But I think, apart from of course the torture, it's a very good symbol of what we are talking about. You know, those regimes had literally buried alive those people, and especially this youth, in a nailed coffin, so that when they had suddenly a little drop of air, they say, ah, what a relief, oh, thanks, President, thanks, Your Highness, thanks, I don't know what, you let me leave, this is over, and this is the revolution. The vanguard role played by the youth is just the ultimate reaction of defense by the most exposed generation against the sterilization of its aspirations, the privatization of its nation state, and the obliteration of its future. But these dynamics of defiance and empowerment will not stop with the toppling of the aging ruler. And days of rage, Yom El Radab, are already announced everywhere and will take place everywhere, inside different parties, unions, associations, even tribes, to depose the existing leadership. It's a regional tide that will leave no sector untouched one way or another. This grassroots pressure will tend to counter the top-down approach of the Arab regimes, alternating the stick of their police repression and the carrot of their paternalistic redistribution. This leaderless resistance will sometimes be pushed back, other times there will be a prolonged standoff, or even a dramatic breakthrough that will reverse the balance of forces. I don't say, and I certainly don't mean, that there will be revolutions everywhere. But the dynamic of revolution is all over the Arab world. And the regime have the choice between suicidal repression, because I believe repression is suicidal for them, not only look at Gaddafi, not only for their nation and people that they are martyrizing in the meantime, and substantive reform. So far, there's only one instance of this anticipated substantial reform. This is Morocco, where, you know, there was a mass protest on February 20, and I saw it was not on your movie. And so the king smartly understood how deep was the anger and the protest. And so on March 9, he delivered a speech as king in front of the people, which is something in Morocco. And then he had a constitutional committee, a new constitution by referendum, on July 1st and the new elections and a new government this fall. So far that's the only instance. Otherwise you have either open crisis, with of course Syria now being the worst, or you know, negation of reality, or you know, cronyism through oil rent. Just imagine this Arab revolution with the oil at $20-$25. I can tell you, you would have had 1 hour long of revolutions, half an hour more, because basically the fact that oil is so high help a lot of regime to buy time, to buy everything and everyone, including time. Sorry. The Berlin Wall of the Arabs was the wall of fear. It has crumbled in Tunisia and was torn down in Egypt. Libya yesterday, Syria today, prove dramatically how far a power-addicted dictator can go to punish his own people for daring to resist. But the fear of the ominous palace, you know, in the Arab world, it depends from the palace, el qasr, but you're so afraid you don't even say it. You say, and you look at the ceiling, you know, the guy on top, you know, and then you don't speak. The fear of the ominous palace is gone and will not come back. Instead, another fear is lingering, the dizziness when facing the sudden uncertainty of the post-autocrat future, or the deeply rooted anguish in countries who suffered civil wars in a recent past and or are divided along sectarian lines. Obviously the case in Syria today, maybe tomorrow Algeria. The post-revolutionary vertigo can reverberate in a positive or a negative way in the neighboring countries, while any radical protest will be hindered by the minority syndrome. And you know, in this wonderful world we're living here, everybody is a victim and everybody is a minority. So even the one who are killing say, oh, we are a victim. And even when they are a majority, they say, we are a minority. So we face, you know, the risk of annihilation. So it is futile and not very decent to indulge into short-term prophecy and wonder aloud about domino effect and who's next. Because there is no Arab system where to play domino. But there is, and I know there will be a fascinating presentation about that tomorrow, a vibrant Arab public sphere structured by social networks and satellite channels. What we see today is that the old order is challenged everywhere through the advent of this new generation of approximately 100 million young Arab women and men who have been energized through a new language, which is the language of revolution, because only non-Arabs believe Arabs speak Arabic. Arabs know they speak one Arabic. Well, until yesterday, it was one colloquialized Arabic, but there was a problem of homogenization of the language because the spoken Arabic was not totally understandable or understood from one country to another. Just to give an example, when Nasser was speaking through Saut al-Arab, Voice of the Arabs, everybody listened to him, and of course everybody understood him, but first nobody in Cairo expected anybody to react and to speak back. It was a leader speaking to the masses, so it was totally the top-bottom approach. And anyway, at that time, if an Algerian wanted to speak to an Egyptian, it was quite complicated for very linguistic reasons, because their colloquial were not matching. What we saw through various, it's a complex phenomenon, what we saw is this homogenization of language through mass education, Arabization, with of course all their problems, shortcomings, and so on and so forth. And what is more important, this secularization of Arabic, which doesn't mean that you don't deliver a religious message through this modern standard Arabic, MSA, but it certainly is popularized and spread all over the region through non-religious tools. And as we know, since McLuhan, media is the message. So it's this new Arabic that energized, that became the language of revolution with brand new slogans. As historian, I must admit, and if you have any information about that, I would be more than happy to welcome it. I don't know where for the first time somebody went into the street and shout, "Eshab, you read, it's called an Islam." The people want the overthrow, wants to overthrow the regime. They don't want the regime to fall. They want them to bring it down. And Nizam is regime and is system, the same word in Arabic. So it's not only Mubarak, now it is the military in Egypt, you know, the Nizam. They know it's not a one-man rule, it's much more complicated than that. So I don't know when for the first time this was uttered, but I know that on one day the same slogan was uttered in 10 different countries, in 100 places, through this dissemination. And of course the slogan, because we're talking about this Arab regional sphere, could be adapted. In Jordan they say, "Shab yurid islah nizam." The people want to reform the system, because you know the Muslim brothers, they don't want open confrontation. In Lebanon they say, "Shab yurid iskat nizam ta'ifi." You know, the people want the fall of the confessional regime, because that's the issue. They know perfectly that the issue of the president is meaningless. It's the whole problem of how the political class is produced. In Morocco, where of course they all love their king the way you all love your queen here, they say, "Eshab yurid iskat el fasad." They want the fall of corruption. In Palestine, they say, especially in Gaza, "Eshab yurid inahal inkisam." The people want the end of division. So you have at the same time the regional dynamic, which is also linguistic dynamics and a generational dynamics, and the adaptation. Because what we see, and it's quite a paradox, is that all those revolutions, there is a double dialectics. One is about this regional movement, but that is giving momentum, impetus, to revolutions that are basically taking place in the framework of the post-colonial borders, and who are in fact the consecration of those borders. Since Syria and Lebanon established official diplomatic relations in 2008, the carving up of the Middle East by Great Britain and France, with the subsequent blessing of the League of Nations 1 century ago, has been finally endorsed. The Israeli-Palestinian dispute is enduring, but inside the territorial framework of the British Mandate over Palestine that the United Nations had decided back in 1947 to partition between a Jewish and an Arab state. The Israeli-Syrian state of war will formally exist until a settlement is reached on the occupied Syrian Golan, annexed by Israel in 1981, but the ceasefire lines have been calm for the past 4 decades until Bashar tried twice to send, you know, further cannon on the Golan, which backfired inside Damascus because the Palestinians killed the security people who had sent them over there, because they say, to put it bluntly, "Listen, you didn't do one thing on behalf of us concretely, and now you want us to be killed to save your skin? No, that won't do." So which is now Palestinian refugees in Syria are more or less neutralized. That means concretely talking about the terror machine of the Syrian regime is that when they want to attack this neighborhood and there is a Palestinian concentration, they go to the Palestinian very quietly and they say, please, move to another place, let us kill our own people, and then you can come back. This is the way it goes now in Syria. So the Arab nation states stand firmly behind their post-colonial borders, and the Arab revolution, far from sweeping away those borders, is a heterogeneous mix of movements of various extents, depths, and scopes inside those very borders. The same, this crucial role of the Arab public sphere and the emulation process between the parallel protest doesn't mean that it's a pan-Arab movement. You know, Tunisians have never been more Tunisian, Egyptians more Egyptians, and even more Libyan. But this nationalist rationale is in fact a new aspiration at developing a full-fledged Arab renaissance following the 19th century Arab Nahda, triggered in its time, I'm sorry to mention his name, by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1798. You know, yesterday in Edinburgh, I saw all the standards that were taken from the poor French soldiers by the Scottish guards, you know, and they still have it today. Yeah, what can I say? By the French invasion of Egypt in 1798, and stem from the ambivalent nature of this foreign aggression that destabilized the Ottoman rule, but also fostered the cultural innovation in Egypt, and after that, in the whole southern shore of the Mediterranean. The satellite channels of that time were the dozens of newspapers launched through the dissemination of the printing press, with the subsequent upgrading and relative democratization of standard Arabic. The Facebook kids of that century were the young graduates who formed a cosmopolitan elite, often at odds with its religious hierarchy, whether Muslim or Christian, with a strong feedback from the diaspora settled in Europe and the Americas. And the revolutionary message at that time was already twofold. Parliamentary reformism on one side, Arab-led Islamism on the other, the two currents converging during the First World War in two various shades of Arab nationalism that sided up eventually with the colonial empires against the post-Ottoman Turks. Tunisia and Egypt were already at the forefront of this Arab Renaissance, with the consolidation in both countries of modernizing dynasties that only depended nominally from the Ottoman Empire. You know, Tunisia abolished slavery 2 years before France and established in 1861 a constitution that basically separated political from religious power. And of course, 1881 was the French protectorate on Tunisia, and the following year you had the domination of British troops in Egypt. But if you look at Tahrir, the parallel Tahrir 2011, the parallel is clear with the 1919 Egyptian revolution, where already the urban elite managed to energize working class protest. The city riot soon spreading to the rural areas, and the Muslim-Christian national unity repeatedly stressed in front of the British divide-and-rule tactics. The same with the Libyan insurgency and Omar al-Mukhtar as a symbol, and the assimilation between the fascist colonial ruler and the present 42 rule of Gaddafi. By reclaiming and incorporating the historical Nahda into its own renaissance, the Arab Revolution rejuvenates a nationalist narrative that is beefed up through its own dynamics. The regimes whose overthrow is called for are portrayed as alien to their own nation and people, as legitimate targets in a genuine fight for self-determination. The fascinating process is not only that this nationalist movement remains delimited by the post-colonial borders, but also that there has been so far no anti-Western outburst. It is the contrary. I don't know if it will be the case here, but now frequently I am accused of being a Mossad, Sarkozy, Qatar agent, you know, supporting a post-colonial plot. You get the story. Aimed at destroying nationalist regime through the imposition of Islamist dictatorship. Wow, that's something. Huh? Anyway, the democratic movement finds its greatest stumbling blocks when the traumatic legacy of a recent civil war is enhanced by sectarian strife as experienced in Yemen, Syria, or Lebanon. The protest dynamics have already led to the fall of the autocrat in all the countries we saw, to the resignation of the prime minister, the caretaker he had nominated, to the constitution of new governments, to the constitutional process. In fact, it only has been really on track in Tunisia. So far in Egypt, when people say Islamists are in power, no, Islamists are in parliament. That's a big difference, you know. The power is still with the military. We don't even know in Tunisia, in Egypt, how the new government will be formed, how the new constituent assembly will be formed, when will be the real presidential election and transfer of power. So it's very, a lot of unknowns. The Arab Revolution is at the same time democratic, popular, and inclusive. The various movements favor peaceful process. They stuck to it in Egypt and Tunisia, but they have been compelled to violence in Libya by the unleashing of the ruthless repression by Gaddafi's regime, and they are now resisting to that trap in Syria, despite the bloodbath. So far, the Syrian Free Army is only defending certain section of insurgent held territories. They are not into the offensive. Peace, as long as the option is open, is a strategic choice to confront the violence of the ruling regime, its army, militias, and thugs. Beltagia in Egypt, Shabiha in Syria. A new balance of power is created through resilience to the armed provocations. One of the main rallying cries in all the demonstrations is Silmiya, peaceful, to stay steadfast in the middle of the clashes. This echoes the 1919 Egyptian revolution against British colonialism, many years before Gandhi, by the way. And this exaltation of civil disobedience could have far-reaching implications in a region marred by armed conflicts and tensions. Despite hundreds of martyrs, the uprising in Tunisia and Egypt has not generated a cycle of revenge or retaliation. This is an indication of an advanced maturity that is in turn critical to the preservation of the democratic, popular, and inclusive dimension of this militant renaissance. Far beyond Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, those movements are democratic in their refusal to stand behind an alternative leader that would just replace the ruling one. They want a transparent and accountable government, the abolition of martial law or state of emergency, the end of police brutality, and the punishment through judgment for corruption. Human rights activists, judges, and lawyers are a crucial component in this mobilization, even in post-war Libya, where they embody the spirit of the insurgency much more than the Jamahiriya's defectors. The various shades of the Arab uprisings are popular, and they have proved so far to be well-disciplined. Those protest movements are inclusive because they know the autocrats have always played on the antagonism between Islamist and secular, or manipulated the sectarian divide. The capacity of this democratic intifada to sustain and to substantiate this inclusiveness is without any doubt the key to its future and success. The Arab Revolution is a democratic renaissance. It will suffer backlashes, betrayals, defeats, and vicious repression. Once the initial enthusiasm fades away, this uprising and its actors will be slandered, vilified, and caricatured. Even when its most radical demands will be eventually fulfilled in the political arena, the rehabilitation of governance will be only one part of a daunting challenge to cope with the deficits in the labor market, in the housing sector, or in the public infrastructure. Those are the Arab deficits. They bear no relation with culture nor religion, but they need decades to be addressed. History is in the making. The Arab Renaissance and the Arab Revolution is only beginning. Thank you very much.
So, now, the debate.
Don't tell me you agree with everything. I can't believe it.
I have a question.
Please.
You were talking a bit at the beginning about the use of carrots and sticks, and I was wondering if you could expand on that in terms of how we in the European Union and in the United States can use that in Syria, for instance, because it seems that we've decided that we aren't going to intervene as we did in Libya. So I'm wondering how we can have an influence in the revolutions in Syria with carrot and stick approaches.
Know that that's a 25 million people question, because they're literally the fate of people that have already nearly suffered a year of incredible repression, because what we hear now, 6,000, is probably far below the reality of the human toll in Syria. And it's very difficult to answer that question, because Libya, by many standards, it was easy, but it was not easy on the ground, but it was easy to design a way to tip the balance, you say that, on one hand. And it was crucial in Libya, because if Gaddafi would have restored his power, his first victim would have been the Tunisian Revolution. He would have, you know, unleashed a fifth column of Libya-paid provocateurs, agitators into Tunisia. So it was not only about Libya, it was about protecting Tunisia and in a relative way, Egypt, even though Egypt had its own problems already. So, let's listen to the revolution. What do the revolutionaries say and ask for in Syria? They don't want foreign military intervention, certainly not. Because of Iraq. I didn't want, because I'm here on British land, you know, so I don't want to be too harsh on 2003. And Iraqi freedom, but this is probably today one of the main handicaps of the revolution. What was done, and done in such a way, in Iraq in 2003. Libya, this is what they talk about at the Security Council. In Syria, they only think about Iraq. And probably the protest movement in Syria would have started a long time before if it was not for the Iraq invasion. The Damascus Springs was very vibrant at the beginning of the 2000, 2001, 2002, and was virtually strangled by the propaganda that followed the Iraqi invasion, because even the most critical Syrians say, well, if this is what is going to happen to us when Bashar is out, maybe better stick to Bashar, you know, because it's not only the invasion, this is the systematic destruction of a state, the chaos, the civil wars, the militias, and it's not over. It's not because the boys are back home that it's over, you know. Iraq will have to live with this legacy for 4 years, even generations. It's a total disaster. So the good news is that post-colonial borders hold, that there was no spillover of the Iraqi chaos on the other neighboring countries. Because basically, no matter how artificial is modern Iraq, this is Iraq. And people are slaughtering each other in Iraq to get power in Iraq, not to something outside. But at the same moment, you have 1 million refugees in Syria, who all told incredible stories of rapes, massacres, destitution. And it really inhibited, you know, any idea of calling for the white knights to interfere. Nobody wants, you know, Western direct interference. So the issue is, of course, about, it has to be, if there would have been a resolution in the UN, it's okay, you can go on with, it's not a no-fly zone they need, because so far they never used airplanes. You know. Maybe they will use in Homs very soon. That's a big fear now, that they will go bombing the insurgent neighborhood in Homs after the tanks and after all that. But so far the issue is not about the airplanes. The issue is about a safe area that could only be at the border with Turkey. So all this implied a complex mechanic of NATO, UN, blah, blah, blah. But it has to be with the UN mandate, otherwise it's impossible. Otherwise it will generate regional tension escalating into a crisis. So now you have to know that the regime, why is the regime? Now, if they call me now and tell me Bashar fell, I will not be surprised. I will be overwhelmed by joy, but I will not be surprised. But it could last. You never know with this regime, because you cannot know where are the fault lines. You don't see them until it just, and it's over. And you have no, there won't be a prolonged agony. It will be very brutal. Like Gaddafi. Gaddafi, in 48 hours, it was over. So you don't know. Nobody knows what is happening inside. And fortunately, we don't know, because if we know it, the people we know are already dead, because they would be spotted by the repression over there. So economic sanctions work in Syria. They work very efficiently. Now there are tales in Syria of the government printing fake money. How do you fake money? To pay is thugs, because it's over, you know. So they put a lot of money in Lebanon and all this and all that. So obviously the thing, this is the end of the cycle. But what is Bashar betting for? Very simple, a war between Israel and Iran. And then, unfortunately, that could save him, because that would generate such a chaos in the area. So that could be his only way to protect his power. So you see how there is a coalition of the hoax and the dictators and the autocrats to against the people. That's nothing new. This is the way they've been doing for a long time, except now it's obvious. So the thing is, of course, when you see all that coming from Syria, it's terrible. But at the same time, I don't want to sound, you know, my heart is bleeding with them. It is their history. You know, the Libyans now have a national narrative. They had no national narrative except from Omar al-Mukhtar until recently. The Syrians now are building through this terrible process, and history is tragic, tomorrow's Syria. Yeah? They are building it through dedication, sacrifice, martyrdom, you know, and it will be totally different from Egypt, because in Egypt the revolution started the day Mubarak fell, one could say, and we're only in the middle of it. In Syria, when it's over, it is really over, you know, because the regime will be dismantled. Whole part of, now approximately 50% of the country is out of control of the regime, which doesn't mean that it's held by the insurgency, but it means that it's all you have, and you have very new structures of committees, Tansikiyat coordination committees, and so on and so forth. So all this is already the prefiguration of the new Syria, and it's not militia run. That's the big difference with Libya. It's basically civilians, a lot of women being involved into that, with different shades and organized. It's not the same in Homs, it's not the same in that neighborhood in Homs and then the next one. And so here we are, you know, those people who have to provide them shelter and help and everything you can imagine. If they decide they want something different from us, we have to listen to them and carefully study and hopefully answer positively. I don't know. I can't say more than that.
Thank you, Professor, for your interesting lecture. I'd like to ask you two questions. First one is, why did these revolutions, protests, and crises of governance happen almost at the same time in Arab world? And the second question is, which is the most viable solution for the Syrian crisis? What's the difference of the Syrian crisis, for example, from the Libyan one? Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, historians have always an answer to explain why revolutions start when the revolution is over. So I won't, you know, go into this. But what is sure is that the main reason for the revolution is the Shabab, is the youth. It doesn't mean that it would have happened this year or that, but the potential. I have a problem with my colleagues in political science because they say generation is not a class. I say it's not a class, but they did the revolution in the Arab world. You know, it's not the working class, it's not the peasant, it's not the blah, blah, blah. This is the youngsters, the Shabab. And Arabs are very generous. You can be Shabab pretty late. You know, sometimes you meet Shabab, they don't have my age, but they are not that far from it. But that's not the issue. Because that means that being a Shabab, being a young, means being a revolutionary. Because, to make a very long story short, and I try to explain all that in the book, you had this clique that were already unbearable, very violent, very cruel, at the time of their fathers. But at least, you know, the various rulers had something to put forward, you know, fighting for the independence, this or that, you know, something you could credit them for. Of course, it was dubious, it was very often a reconstructed history and all that. But Bourguiba achieved something for Tunisia, Ben Ali. The only feat of Ben Ali was putting a gun behind four doctors who went to see aging Bourguiba and decided the guy was loony. That's the only thing brave Ben Ali achieved in his life. And so imagine Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad. You know, all this new generation had just inherited the power. And you have met Hafez al-Assad and some of those people repeatedly. You could say anything about them, that they were cold-blooded killers and so on and so forth, but they were not interested in Rolex and Ferrari and top models. They couldn't care less. They wanted power. And when you visited them, it was there was absolutely no luxury. They were living, they were vampires living on the pure blood of power. They didn't need it. They didn't need ostentation. While when you're coming to the Bashar of this time, to the Gamal Mubarak, to the Saif al-Islam Qaddafi with his white tiger in his Monaco flat, you're changing totally. That's the rule of the game. And it's not that they are greedy, you know. They can't stop. Those people were like a flock of locusts, you know, just, you know, downing on their own country and eating everything. And for those youngsters, they knew perfectly that if you don't get the good connection or the good protection, you are living dead. You will only live to feed up those people. And oil is not only the main fuel of counter-revolution, it's the main antidote against revolution. And Tunisia, fortunately, has no oil. So in Tunisia, it was very clear that any penny was taken from the pockets of the Tunisians. So one day it was over. And they say, and the moment it was over, literally. And even Ben Ali felt it, you see. So Syria, it's more complex, because Syria, you have the whole legitimacy of the anti-Israeli fight and of the Arab identity, which is why it's crucial to have an Arab plan pushed forward by Arab states. It's not like Libya, where basically they paid lip service to a NATO plan. This plan is an Arab plan. And it's about transition and evolution of power from number one to number two. But everyone who knows those regimes in Yemen, as in Syria, knows there is no number two. So if you, which is why, you know, in Yemen, he refused for 6 months, and he was bombed, and he was this, and he was that, before finally and reluctantly accepting, because they know it's over after that. Because there is no number two. Number two is only, it's only a name. And especially in Syria, when number two is Sunni and number one is Alawite, the moment an Alawite gives back power to a Sunni, it's over. Which doesn't mean it's chaos, it's ruins and all that. But this is the very rationale behind the plan. Which is why the Russians are sticking to their refusal, because they know the very structure of the power, and they know that it's not that there is no room for negotiation. Personally, I think there is no room for negotiation, and the Syrian revolution definitely says there is no room for negotiation. But it's not a regime that knows how to negotiate. It's them or us. So the very idea, the very simple idea of transferring power from number one to number two means, in fact, that you are in the February 2011 in Tunisia or March 2011 in Egypt. And the thing will be unraveling very quickly, and the number two will be out after a few weeks. So that's the only scenario. So that's a way just to make the transition a little bit less bloody. But that's the only way. They have to go anywhere. Russia, Iran, but let them leave, and nobody will shed a tear when they disappear. Yes?
Thank you again for a really informative and interesting presentation. In the presentation, you touched on the idea of differences in the Arabic language between colloquialisms. But I think everybody's on the experience in this equation, the revolution. I was just wondering, in the context of that, if you could comment on whether you think it's uniting or dividing the Arab world.
I'm not sure. What would you answer to what is uniting and dividing Europe, for example? So I don't see. It's complex, you know. At the same time, what I try to portray is that it's a revolutionary feeling, a feeling of urgency that is shared all over the Arab world. So today, you know, if I wanted ironically to answer you, what is shared among the Arabs is revolution. What is dividing them is the borders, but they accept the borders. Because basically they don't want to make the revolution, they want to kick out their own local dictator. You know, they're happy when it happens with the neighbors, but basically the Syrians, they don't want Libyans or Iraqis to come and fight with them. They want to do the job by themselves. You know, they want support, they want solidarity, they want all this, they want all that, but they consider this is their own history and they have to go all their way to the end. But it's certainly the whole because it's not black and white. For example, now in North Africa, the revolutionaries are clearly far more pan-Maghrebi, you know, in favor of regional integration than the powers in place. And you see now the Tunisian president, Marzouki, shuttling between the various North African capitals to promote the relaunching of the Arab-Maghreb Union, you know, the AMU that is virtually frozen by the Algerian-Moroccan dispute. So in that case, they are far more advanced than more of the local parties. But at the end of the day, they are Algerians, Tunisians, and Libyans. And you didn't ask it, but I will say it, you know, when it comes to the Islamists, that are very often portrayed as a, you know, a tentacular organization with branches, very soon, mark my word, you will see Tunisian Islamists and Egyptian Islamists clashing as Tunisians and Egyptians. If there is a conflicting national interest, the problem of national interest will be far more important for them than the fact that they are both Islamists, you see. But it's a dialectic. So it's what is sure is that this revolution gives a renewed pride to the Arabs, you know, as contributors to such a movement. But also, when you say Arab revolution, one should not underestimate the importance of ethno-linguistic minorities in this movement. The Berbers, certainly in North Africa. In Libya, the fighting in the Jebel Nafusa was crucial. King of Morocco understood it perfectly because one of his revolutionary announcements was making the Berber the second official language after Arabic. In Syria, the Kurds are playing a great role, and you have an ongoing debate about the new Syria being named either Arab Syrian Republic, like today, Syrian Arab Republic, or being called the Syrian Republic, because for the Kurds, this is one of their main... So we'll see, but it's open, and it's quite fascinating. Yes?
I'm curious, why do you think that there was no revolution or uprising in countries like Saudi Arabia, and do you believe that whatever they're doing to keep themselves together is sustainable?
Oh. Have you an idea of how much money was dispersed by the Saudi regime?
About 60 billion?
No, double the figure. The first announcement was a little bit less. Now they are around $130 billion. And, you know, and when you read the list, you know, it's like, you know, being sure that everybody got something somewhere, you know. They have been pumping money. Okay, they can do it. You know, their oil reserves are twice that high. So, but at least they are spending it. You know, Gaddafi never spent it in Libya. You know, he just put everything in Switzerland or I don't know where. So at least Saudi Arabia. Again, I have an old argument about that. Saudi, if you follow me a little bit with my Nahda interpretation. Saudi Arabia is the only Arab country that was never colonized. It makes a big difference. You know, it's very difficult to have an alternative Saudi nationalism to the Saudis because, you know, it's a country that was literally built around the ruling dynasty. So things will happen, certainly. I'm sure about it. But they have... they are very, you know, it's not a one-man game, for example. You know, the fact that you have a royal family of 3,000, you know, conservative estimate, means that they are far better connected to the society than the other regimes, because they have people everywhere, one way or another, who keep receiving. So, at the same time, the amount of corruption is so shocking now in Saudi Arabia. But I met a lot of Saudi opponents, even revolutionaries, and after a while I discovered that they were all, I was thinking, real revolutionaries of your age, you know, not, you know, people like me. So the real revolutionary, they're all living on government scholarship. Well, that would be a revolution that would happen thanks to people who are on the scholarship of the regular government. They want to tell. That would be new. That would be something new. So, at the same time, the regime is facing, you know, many problems. Yemen, they didn't handle it very smartly. Qatar is much more proactive and is, you know, shaming Saudi Arabia every day. But things are definitely under control. And one last thing. You had, only a few years ago, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, terror wave all over the Saudi country that was defeated for many reasons, but that left a scar. Always you can see that people and societies that recently lived a bloody wave of unrest and violence are more reluctant than others to go in the streets.
You mentioned the importance of judges and lawyers. Uh-huh. Do you think that members of the Fula regime should be recognized in the Hague nations or at the Hague?
I'm not sure I got the whole question. And I didn't understand the member of the former regime should be what?
Do you think they should be recognized in the Hague nations or at the Hague?
The question is only asked for one person, if I am correct. You're talking about Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. I don't see other occurrences. Or you have the next you have other instances of that, or you're talking only about Saif al-Islam? Okay. So about Saif again, as I try to portray, you're talking about nationalist uprising. So they basically want to judge their own dictators at home. There is a big problem now in Libya with the judiciary. And it's quite a paradox because Abdel Jalil, so the now ruler of Libya, was Minister of Justice of Gaddafi until very recently. And he has a lot of lawyers around him, so one could have expected them to be a little bit more rigorous in the law process. Now, the last Human Rights Watch report underlined very serious concerns and that an understatement about the way people are jailed, interrogated and tortured by the various militias. So before even going to The Hague or the they have to dismantle the militias and the parallel system of jails and torture. You know, it cannot be. You cannot have a new Libya without it's not only a shadow, it's a stain, you know. You cannot build on it. And then, of course, the judiciary, the due process, and all that. The way Mubarak is being tried today in Egypt, you can make a lot of criticism, but it makes sense and it's quite respectable. Talking about Saudi Arabia, I see a big crisis coming between Tunisia and Saudi Arabia about Ben Ali. They want to try Ben Ali at home, and they won't be satisfied with the idea that We gave our word. Okay, you gave your word, and it just, you know, oppressed us for a generation. So, do you want to stay pal with us, or do you want to keep to your word? You know, it's up to you. So the Saudis will face a very good... It will not happen now, but at one moment, because the nationalist reassertion of Tunisia, like the other, will be very strong. The Saudis will be, I think, forced to deliver Ben Ali or sever relations with Tunisia. So, but for example, if tomorrow Bashar is indicted, and you have many reasons to indict him, does it help in the Syrian crisis? I don't know. I'm not sure. But I'm sure that the Syrians.